Hello and hi, welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, and we are here today to talk to a rather inventive filmmaker, Arvi Raghu, who is the director and writer of a new sci-fi indie, I'm going to say thriller also, called Cerebrum, out May 4th. And Arvi is here to tell us all about this very curious and compelling and just, what's the word I'm looking for? It strings you along, and sometimes that's annoying, but it's good. Arvi, welcome.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you taking the time and having me on.
Well, I'm a fan of indie film, and the past couple of years, it's been harder to find sci-fi. We've got tons of horror, and I love horror, but I think my heart leans towards the sci-fi angle more. And so seeing this coming out, I'm like, ooh, I must know more. And it's a more cerebral, no pun intended, sci-fi adventure. It's a mystery, it's a thriller, and it's about hacking brains and hacking memories. And what happens when that technology is misused for ill-gotten gains. Mm-hmm. Yep. is that about cover it without going into spoilers?
No, yeah, that's perfect. That's perfect. Yeah.
Okay, first off, where in the world did you come up with the idea of let's hack memories and let's have somebody try to steal that tech and use it illegally?
It's kind of like a weird place where it started, right? Like everyone else, I shop on Amazon, which means I go in there, buy a bunch of things. But as you would have noticed, when you scroll down after you buy something, Amazon recommends a bunch of other things that you might buy based on your buying patterns, based on your age and whatnot. It would say, hey, you might be interested in XYZ. So that kind of like provoked the thought of wondering what happens when I die. Can Amazon still send my loved ones the gifts that I would send them? Because it knows what I'm going to get. It knows my patterns. So let's say like I died this year, and maybe for next Christmas, Amazon can find a way to send gifts from me saying like, hey, you would like this XYZ. It kind of started from there, and me being a computer scientist obviously helped. And I was thinking through that and said, okay, so if it's just shopping, what about your Facebook posts? Can Facebook, after you die, still post in your regards and congratulations and likes and whatnot on Facebook? Can Twitter know your patterns and start sending tweets on your behalf? So maybe it was kind of like extending that a little bit more of pushing it and say like, okay, then what happens if you have all this information about you with your banking account, your photos, your likes, your buying patterns, and your travel, where you go, your driving patterns. It's on like the digital footprint of you is like much more than what we think these days, right? So based on that, like, what if we could create a persona? What if we could like have a copy of you somewhere else? What was kind of the thought? And then it eventually evolved into what Cerebrum is today. Okay, so now if you can digitally have you, digital brain somewhere, everything digital can be hacked. You can hack your bank account. Somebody can hack your photos and Photoshop would do a bunch of things with it. So if you have your memory digitized, can somebody hack it? Can somebody use it for something that they, it's not intended for? So that kind of started in that process. So it was more of a gradual once of like, yeah, let's do this. And the initial idea for Cerebrum was more of bringing back a dead person based on their digitized memory, if you may, or based on their online patterns and whatnot. I know I just gave you a nice little plot for somebody to make another movie based on that, but that's where it started. And then I said, okay, that's kind of a little out there. I needed something that's grounded, closer to reality, and started writing Cerebrum. Obviously, the first few drafts are very sciencey, too deep dive into science. There was less human touch to it. That's when I started adding the other elements of the story, the father and the son coming together, and also the thriller aspect of it, right? Like, the guy commits a crime that he cannot remember. How do you go, fix it? And the problem I introduce in the movie is it's not just you thinking you killed somebody. There are evidence showing that you did something wrong. So that's what makes it complicated and him trying to figure that out.
Well, yeah, the initial setup of taking your memories, taking someone's memories and putting them, switching them out, hacking them and putting them back is that's a door
Yeah.
you don't want real software or hardware or technology going through, but it's eventually going to happen. So having a way to remap someone's neural pathways in a way that electronic signature, for lack of a better word, can be captured and digitally stored. What was the science, or was there a science behind the mechanism you that was designed for the movie? Because the etching, the laser tokens, the little watch, all of that was just so cool looking. I'm like, somebody, there's a scientist or engineer back there having a lot of fun.
Okay, yes, well, to start with, I have my bachelor's from mechanical engineering and my master's is in computer science. So I'm through and through a science geek, if you may.
Awesome.
So, yeah, so all the coding and all the putting things together, all that came from the sciencey engineering background that I have. But beyond that, there is definitely a lot of science that is out there today. So, for example, there is Neuralink. Neuralink is taking a monkey's analog signals or brainwave signals and converting them into a digitized signal to control a video game. It just came out like a few weeks ago. So that is purely taking your chemical or your analog signals and converting them into a digital signal. If you can convert them into a digital signal, which means you can store them. If you can store them, and you can potentially be able to do the reverse. If you have a digitized memory, you should be able to do reverse engineers and convert this into a potential analog signal or a brainwave signal and control people. So imagine that, right? Like, you took all this monkey playing a game, how the monkey would control and digitize it. And let's say the monkey has, I don't know, Alzheimer's or memory loss or doesn't figure out how to do it anymore. You can replay this digitized memory back into the monkey's memory. Now it becomes electrical signal. The monkey could actually react to that. So it was just extension of the current science. And the little chip, or what we call this little noggin in cerebrum, it's actually a device that's out there right now. They call it the Superman crystal or MD5 crystals. That one can hold up to, if I'm not wrong, it's 340 terabits or 3,000 terabits. It's like an insane amount of data that it can store. It's real and it's being researched. I want to say Cambridge, London, somewhere in the UK, they are researching it. And actually, I did reach out to those researchers and they came back to me almost like a year after I finished shooting. So didn't really have a lot of things into it, but at least it kind of gave me an idea. So there is a real thing that can hold that amount of insane amount of data in there. So that it kind of came in play. But with everything else you would see as put together props in the movie, that was intentional, right? Because this guy is running a makeshift lab or like a ragtag lab in his barn, and he's not going to have access to beautiful 3D printers and whatnot to make like awesome, clean, slick looking 2024 sci-fi props. He's going to just make things with like rubber bands and glues and whatnot, and that's exactly what we wanted with the look of that. So, yeah, some of my science background and reading and just Being curious with current technology helped me.
Yeah, the news about the how far they've gone with controlling objects with signals from the brains of monkeys is fascinating, because I think the last time I had heard an update, they had electrodes connected to a monkey's brain, and he was actually controlling robot arms or robot hands with thought.
Yep.
And to see that we've come so much farther than that is just fascinating. I will have to learn how to be polite to our future robot overlords, but
They're coming.
oh yeah, they're coming. Can we get the robots to fight the zombies and then just like sit back and like eat popcorn and cheer?
I think that's what Elon Musk is trying to do. He's just trying to train monkeys against zombies.
There you go. I'd play that video game. I'd play that game.
Yeah, well, when I throw out this idea, sometimes I'm like, hey, maybe that's the next movie. It's monkeys against robots.
I'd hold on to that one if I were you.
Yeah, I will.
But in Cerebrum, what was the first thing you thought of as, I guess, the obstacles to our protagonists, Tom and blanking on her name.
Chloe.
Yes. The obstacles they would have to face once nefarious forces looked in their direction.
So there's a lot of layers to Cerebrum. As I wrote it, I put in like way too many for my own comfort. I put a lot of layers, right? There is a little bit of a tidbit I'll give in a little bit because of those layers, but. So the idea there is because of what Tom went through in his early childhood, he has a trust issue, right? Like, he doesn't trust his dad, which means like he doesn't trust anyone. And he went on a date with Chloe, and then because he didn't want any commitment, he kind of like did not see her, did not call her back, kind of things. He never trusted anyone. But as in the movie, one of his biggest obstacle is trying to trust himself, trying to trust Chloe, trying to trust his dad. It kind of is main internal obstacle for Tom to come through, right? It's about, hey, these people are here to help me. But again, in the movie, it happens he trusts someone and that someone just backstabs him. So that's also, pulls him back. But beyond that, on the science part of things, it's mainly Tom is not scientifically educated. He's a tattoo artist who lives in Austin, Texas, away from his dad's rural barn lab. So he doesn't know anything about science, nothing about that. So when it comes to a point of where he has to take the mantle or take the baton and run with it, that's his struggle. Like, how am I going to do this? Who do I trust? Who do I not trust, what do I need to learn, are all those obstacles that he needs to go through. And for as far as Chloe, she's a straight shooter, right? Like she's a fun, spunky, full of energy kind of girl. And she likes Tom, she likes Kirk, but when things go wrong, it's again same thing for her. It's about her going beyond what normal thing is and being able to trust Tom and say, like, maybe he did do something, maybe he did not do something, but there is something good in him that I want to believe and I want to trust him and help him go through this journey. So both for Tom and Chloe, it's mainly about figuring out or creating the trust and going with the gut feeling and, helping each other.
Cool. Now, I don't know how much of a spoiler this would be, but one use of the technology ends up implanting someone's memories into someone else, and that becomes a goal for our bad guys in order to manipulate situations, and their need to continue to do that. There was one point where I got lost with, okay, who is in whose body here? And it was fascinating to watch the actors take on the personas, the actual, in some cases, physical manifestations of the altar that whose memories they had. And I was just floored by that. They worked really hard on that, didn't they?
They definitely did. Yeah, there are like two pointers to that effect, right? So, in the script itself, there were like bunch of mannerisms written for each different characters to set them apart. Tom has his own quirks. Bruno has his own habits of biting his fingernails and whatnot. And then you have Rocky, who has his own German accent, does things differently, says certain words certain ways, kind of establish that pattern within the script. And we kind of repeated that a few times before these kind of switches happen. So you kind of like know, like, hey, if XYZ does this, it is this person. So we kind of like establish that behavioral patterns. But also during shoot, what will happen is when people has to play the other person, he would sit that actor would sit with the other actor and say, like, okay, show me how you would do it. If you were the character, you are the character, and if you have to say this dialogue or if you have to perform this action, how would you go about doing that? They observe the other actor, and when they, when the memory switch happens, they go and be able to like mime it or do that in the same way. So there was an incredible amount of coordination help between all the actors on the set trying to do this.
How much rehearsal time did you have? Because this was a longer than typical indie film. It's actually almost exactly 2 hours. But how long was the shoot and how much rehearsal time did you have?
Rehearsal time was close to none. it's mainly because the way things was just, put together. We were just going, okay, let's make this happen, let's go. And I'm from Houston, people are from LA. We are initially going to shoot Houston, then we scratched it and say everyone is from LA, so let's shoot it in California, move things there and whatnot. So there was a lot of pre-production was taking a lot of time and going at like almost to the end. So we didn't have a whole lot of rehearsal time, although a couple of good points is we got Christian James and Alexis come into like for a table read 5 days before we started shooting, and we had like maybe two or three table reads to just get them get them used to the script, get them used to each other. And also the Andy or Anirudh, who plays Bruno, he's our producer, so he always had the script for a year longer, so he kind of knew the script and knew what his character is going to be and what he needs to play and all that. So in that sense, it kind of helped. And John Ruby is a tremendous actor who picks up things. He's very quick at all that. So with that, it was easy. Not going too far away, there was one scene that we were shooting, and we kind of changed this. Well, we didn't change the scene. We were supposed to shoot that scene that morning, and the AD forgot to send Alexis Lemaire the script, or he missed the 2 pages for that particular scene. So when she came in, she didn't realize we were shooting that scene, and she just came in blank. She thought like she's doing other scenes. We called her and said like, this is the scene. She was just blanking, like, what do you mean we are shooting? What scene is this? Then we realized she didn't get the script. She said, give me 5 minutes. She went into her thing, did 5 minutes of reading, and came back and gave one of the best performances. And I was literally in tears saying, like, man, she's gonna go far.
Nice.
She's definitely gonna go far because she have no clue what the thing is 5 minutes ago, and here she is just making me cry acting, right? So I was very, very fortunate to have like some really good talent around me, which pulled it. I tell all my friends, like, if I didn't have the talent I had, this movie would not be what it is today, right? So that's how we are able to pull off without having a lot of rehearsal time. Going back to the number of shoot days, we shot for 16 days in November 1st. It was kind of like we tried to like overachieve, and by 16th day we kind of realized it's not enough, we need to come back. But that kind of gave me the time to look at the footage and whatnot and figure what else do I need to cover? Are there any scenes we need to remake or reshoot? And then we shot for another 5 days. So the total of like 21 days of shoot is how much we spent on it.
Cool. Yeah, I was going to ask how the post-production, the editing, and the effects, did any of that change in the editing on the editing floor, so to speak? Because there are definitely scenes where you're looking at either really, really cool custom-built electronics or digital overlays, and the seamlessness of some of that was really appealing to me as a tech geek.
So we did the only VFX that you would see in the film is mainly all the laptop screens and stuff that you see on the watches, right? Like I definitely stayed away from like any other cool looking sci-fi. I didn't want to have like this, hologram looking displays, right? Like it's been done so many times, and trust me, even if I had put like thousands of dollars, it's not going to be as cool as Iron Man VFX, right? So there is no point trying to put your like small dollars and trying to make it look like a cool sci-fi or a cool VFX that was made for like millions of dollars. I'm not saying you cannot do it, but if you don't do it right, it's going to look cheap. It's going to fall off, right? So when I started writing the script, I knew there was a limitation, saying like, okay, I'm not going to have a lot of money. So let me not try to attack and try to make this a cool VFX shots. Minimize as many VFX shots as possible. Try to do as many practical effects as possible. So kind of went that route. So on the editing floor, like it was interesting because obviously like they say, right, the movie is made in three different stages. When you write, when you direct, and when you edit. So definitely, I went through all three stages. When I wrote the film, the feeling I had was it was like an Ex Machina meets Girl with a Dragon Tattoo. But when I shot it, it was more like, a different movie. And when we started editing it, it became a different movie. But it was me being open to it more, all the other people being open to it, saying like, it's okay. It's okay for the movie to look different because as long as it tells the story, as long as it keeps the audience engaged, it doesn't matter. Like, what you wrote is not what you're seeing. It's okay to have that. So with that, I was, very fortunate to work with John Blaze, who is my editor from Dallas. He's both very talented and very patient with me, right? He has really good ideas, but when I say like, no, I don't want something like this, even though I spent like 2 weeks editing it, if I want him to change it, he would go change it, right? He would give his idea, saying like, hey, this is why I did it. But if I say like, yeah, John, that's not going to work for me, let's do it this way, he would listen to me, go back and do it better than what I asked for. So that was an incredible experience of working with him and putting this together. The challenge or like the thing that I probably as a director or a producer change in my post-production approach is that I kind of took all of this in different stages, right? Like I did the editing first, then we did the sound editing, then we went back to music, we did the music, came back to sound editing, put that together, and then later on went and did the VFX. It was kind of in different stages. If I were to redo this again, I would probably try to like do them in parallel so I could have done it faster. That's the only regret I have as far as post-production comes. But other than working with the people or how we collaborated, what kind of decisions we made, those were all clean. Those were all the perfect ones.
Well, I guess the digital fiddling with the watches I thought was really, really cool, and the device that actually laser etched the little noggin discs, I thought that was really, really cool because it got across very clearly what it was, what was happening during the etching and the finished product. So that was, I thought that was just a little appealing attention to detail.
Thank you for that. The etching itself that you see is a VFX on that, like, the little little spark thing that goes across the chip and writes the name. That was VFX. But I did do some testing while I was creating the noggin. So there's a public library here that does laser engraving for free. As long as you bring the material, they do the things for free. So I bought a bunch of these acrylic sheets and created those noggins, physically created those noggins, and I needed to etch the names on it. So during the process, I was watching the laser machine and I saw like what it was doing. There was a little bit of smoke, there was a little bit of sparks going up and down. So I took a bunch of video of that. And when it came to VFX time, I sent it to my VFX guy and said, like, hey, this is what the real one looks like. Make it look cooler. So he went and added the lasers and the little bit of smoke coming out and all those nice things.
And I am suddenly very envious that you have a library that will just let you laser etch stuff.
I know that. I didn't know about this library for a long time. Then when I found it, I was like, oh, this is cool. And they even have a 3D printer, and they have like a free class which you can take. They teach you how to use the 3D printer, what to design, how to design it. And then when you design, and you can go back to the library, get a 3D printed object, and the only thing you pay is by the weight. They take the object and weigh it and say, like, okay, it's very cheap. I made like puzzles and whatnot for my kids, and it's like 75 cents, 80 cents, and they love it.
Nice. Where's this at? University of Houston or?
This is Houston Public Library, but in Clear Lake, which is south of Houston.
Nice. Dude, we need to like just give them, 20 million high fives because that is just cool.
Absolutely. And there was definitely a guy named Mitch Long who worked there, and he kind of helped me. He was very happy. He was like, oh, you're making a movie. This is a prop movie. Okay, I'll help you out. And he was very enthusiastic and patient to just walk me through all the different setups and whatnot to get it done. So yeah, definitely kudos to those people who just wants to help others.
Nice. Awesome. So for you in getting this film made, what was the thing you looked forward to most, and what ended up actually being the most satisfying part of it?
Okay, definitely as a director, the thing that you look forward to is being on the set and directing your actors and making things happen. And I want to say that was definitely something that I enjoyed. It was, even though it was just a short 21 days and east of Eastern California, which was hitting like 30 degrees in the night during December, 32 during the day. It was rough, but very, very enjoyable, something that I'm going to hold on to for a very long time. So the process of waking up every day and figuring things out and talking to the cinematographer and figuring out where we're going to place the camera, where are the actors going to be, where, talking to the actors. And my background is from acting. I took a bunch of acting classes and all that. So I am very passionate about working with actors, right? The way of, like, telling them what you need, what kind of emotions you're looking for, what kind of internal monologue that is going on in their head when they say certain things. Those are the things that I really enjoy, and those are great process in this one. The thing that I did not anticipate and did enjoy tremendously was when we were putting together the music. Usually, for most of my short films, it's my wife. She composes all my music. She composed music for all my short films. She's a tremendous musician. Like, she plays piano, drums, guitar, you name it, she plays it, right? So she composed all the music. So usually what happens is she knows what my thought process is. And I would say, this is what I want, and she would go score it, put it on, put the movie together, and say, like, voila, we are done. Right. But with this one, because it's a feature film and she has a full-time job that's not playing music, she's also a fellow IT geek, we said it's not going to be possible. Like, she needs to dedicate a good 6 months scoring all the music. It's not going to be possible. So we went and sought out the composer, Edward Antonio. He lives in New York. I live in Houston. So working with him on Zoom calls, we would get on a call, we would have like 3 or 4 hour calls per scene, or per reel, couple of scenes. We would talk about each character emotions, what kind of music we want, what kind of instrument could help, what is the character thinking. And also, as you would know, the character switches, like the character's behavior changes. So the music had to change along with, progressively change along with the character. So I wasn't anticipating to have a good time doing the music. I thought, like, okay, music, I'm gonna call XYZ, tell them this is the script, go watch the cut, make a music, thank you very much. But it became a process of very close collaboration with Ed, and I really enjoyed that. Like, it was long conversations we will have. He will score something, send it to me, I will listen and say, like, it's not working, this is what I want, we will go rework. So that entire process was really, I loved doing that.
Awesome. Now, you wrote this and you directed it. Is your future projects, are you looking for other things that other people have written, or do you want to continue in that vein of writing it and then directing it yourself?
It's going to be both, right? So I would definitely like to direct somebody else's script, but that's where I started. I wanted to definitely, directing is the path I want to go with. But with Cerebrum, I knew it's going to be my first feature film. So it's not like somebody with like an awesome script is going to come and say, like, hey, first time director, please go direct my script. Not going to happen. And then I realized the scripts that I could get my hands on, that I could direct, they were not something that I was interested in. They were not, they didn't have the story that I was looking for, was not interesting. So I said, okay, well, I have to write it. If I want to make my feature film and I want to make the story good, then I have to do that. So I kind of like sat and wrote it. Although I'm not a writer, I gave myself so many excuses not to write, right? Like, I would set up my desk, I had my paper, I had everything there. I would sit down to write, and then I would be like, man, my knee is hurting, I don't think I can write. Imagine that. I would just come up with like any crazy excuse I can give not to write that day. But eventually I had to push myself to, like, sit my bum down and write it. It's a process I enjoy, but not as much as I enjoy directing. So long story short for that answer, I'm open to both. And the next thing, I'm definitely looking around for scripts that somebody had already written so I can quickly get on to my next film. Although I have a few ideas that I'm cooking up, but those are something that would need another 2 years to flesh out and make it clean.
If you were going to give a piece of advice to someone who is aspiring to be a film director themselves, what would it be?
I think it was during Oscar, somebody said this, maybe I'm paraphrasing this, but it just like hit a nerve on me, is a director is a jack of all trades, master of none. You need to know all the in and outs. You just cannot think like, oh, I know how to use a camera, I want to be a director. Your picture is going to look good, but it's not going to sound good. It's not, the acting is not going to be good. You could say like, I'm an actor, I want to direct, then the acting is going to be phenomenal. You're going to be losing out on the cinematography and editing part. Anyone who wants to pursue the path of director, try to get your hands on as many different aspects of filmmaking as possible. Go be a PA for somebody. If you get an acting part to be a somebody's side gig, do that. Like, and if you get a chance to edit your friend's video, go for an edited, learn the process. If you have a process of helping somebody compose your music, do that. Like, get involved in the different aspects of the filmmaking, which makes you a very strong director when you learn all those things.
Awesome, awesome. So, where can people find you online to check out whatever it is you're working on next?
All right. Well, I mean, right now you can check. You can find me on IMDb. RV Raghu. I hope there is no other RV Raghu on IMDb. If there is somebody, I'm gonna find him. Yeah, you can definitely find me on IMDb. That's the best place to get hold of me. Or if you want to follow along There's definitely a cerebrummovie.com website. So it's cerebrummovie.com website where we are putting all the trailers, actors, bios, and all that. And that my email is also there. And using all that information, you should be able to find me on Facebook or Instagram. So if you find me, just add me. I'm happy to have more friends and help people out. Yeah, that's that. And I know you said May 4th, the movie is coming out. I just wanted to add a couple of extra information to that, if that's okay. So it's coming out May 4th. It's coming out in both Dish Network and DirecTV On Demand. It will be on Vudu, and then it will be on Amazon Direct, not Amazon Prime, but Amazon Direct, where you go pay or rent the movies. It will also be out on DVDs in Walmart. I don't know which Walmarts it's coming out in, but it's DVD that's being pushed out to Walmart. This is in US, May 4th is in US, and we will be coming out in UK in June. The platforms are not decided, so it's still pending, but it's coming out in June. And possibly in between that or after that, we will be coming out in Taiwan. Some of the teasers that they put out in the Taiwanese market are just had already had like 150,000 views and whatnot. So we are kind of excited for it to be shown in Taiwan. And we are having some talks with folks in Germany and Australia and stuff like that. So hopefully we can get Cerebrum out to more parts of the world.
A very slow rolling global rollout, which is kind of a good thing because it gives time for, friends to talk to friends all over the place and say, hey, check this out.
Exactly. That's the hope, and it's not. Again, it's not a big budget movie, right? So we're not expecting a global, crazy release and that goes crazy for the first 20 days. So we are hoping this would be like a more of a slow burner where people kind of talk about it and, hey, how the movie was kind of interesting from the beginning, and there's like a bunch of things that happened at the end and that kept them thinking. They wanted to go back and rewatch it or whatnot. Those kind of things. We hopefully like, organically grows the movie audience.
Awesome. Well, Arvi, thank you so much for your time today.
Absolutely. Thanks for taking the time. This has been fantastic for me to, talk about the movie, but also the filmmaking process together, right?
Yeah, that's Arvi Raghu, the writer director of the film Cerebrum, should be available on one of your favorite platforms. Go check it out. And we will be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this.
Escape Pod is your destination for the best in modern short science fiction. Our intrepid crew of editors and hosts will bring you fun, thought-provoking in-flight entertainment every week as the pod careens around the multiverse. In the mood for a classic? We've got Anson Mount, also known as Captain Christopher Pike, reading Theodore Sturgeon. Want something a little more up-to-date? Jennifer R. Donahue's surveillance fatigue has you covered in every sense. From classic space opera to intimate character drama, from heroic alien pets waiting for their families to herds of Einsteins and the benevolent conspiracy they're hatching, Escape Pod has it all. Take a ride with us at escapepod.org and buckle up because it's story time.
Hey guys, this is Arjun Gupta from Sci-Fi's The Magician. You are listening to Slice of Sci-Fi.
And again, the movie is Cerebrum, should be available now through any of the retailers, digital and physical, that RV mentioned. It is an interesting movie. The special effects are incredible. The actor performances are compelling. Some of them draw you in. It is a little confusing, as I said, sometimes when they're switching bodies, but the story slows down too much in more than a few places, and I honestly can't think of how that could have been edited differently because there's so much that needs explaining. But I enjoyed it for the most part. And if you can, go check it out for yourself. What do you think would be a good topic, a good premise for an indie sci-fi feature? Because right now, indie horror is outpacing indie sci-fi by about 5-1. And I honestly don't know what I could do to help that. If you have an idea, I'm all ears. I would like to signal boost some indie sci-fi that is trying to get off the ground. Rod over at Seventh Matrix does an awesome job with short film showcases. And, you know, thank goodness, bless him for that. Because I find a lot of interesting stories through the work he does. And if there's a spot for indie sci-fi that I'm missing, please let me know. Send me an email, summer@sliceofscifi.com. Or hit me up on Twitter, @sliceofscifi. You know by now I definitely get into conversations on Twitter. So point me at somebody's Twitter handle, point me at somebody's website, and I will do some digging. And contact me there on Twitter or by email if you have any other questions or comments on Cerebrum or any other films we've covered, any other interviews we've done. Start up a conversation. And there's also the website, sliceofscifi.com. Come on by, continue a conversation, start a conversation. Let's talk sci-fi. I'd like to thank everyone who is currently helping to support Slice of Sci-Fi and all of the other podcasts and websites in the Slice of Sci-Fi universe. Your donations really do help keep things humming online here, so thank you. Thank you all for that. If you'd like to add your support, the place to go is patreon.com/sliceofscifi. Pick a tier, any tier, and you will be eligible for perks. Every month I pick an email address out of the hat, and that person gets to choose a Blu-ray, a 4K, a DVD, a book from the stash here, because I am running out of space to keep it all, so I would rather pass the swag on to the listeners and supporters here. Thank you so much. Like I said, all of you are helping keep Slice of Sci-Fi online, Writers After Dark, Babylon Podcast, Charlie Jade, A Different Point of View, all of that stays online because of your help. So thank you. And if a donation every now and then is more your speed, the link you can use is paypal.me/sci-fi summer. But that will do it for this episode. I want to thank you all for listening, and we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi next week. Take care.